I want to thank Professor Berardi for this invitation and the law faculty of the University of Padua. It is a great honor. I think it is appropriate, speaking at a law faculty, to begin with some abstract considerations on the foundations of law, and then proceed to more concrete details regarding democracy in particular. First, I want to explain what I refer to as the problem of social order. Why is it that we do need any norms whatsoever? Imagine for a second that we would live in the Garden of Eden, where there is all around superabundance of everything that we need. Whatever we want, we can immediately get it. We only have to stretch out our hands and have all goods available to us. In the Garden of Eden, conflicts between different people are practically impossible. Whatever I take, I do not take anything away from anybody else. There is sufficient stuff around for anyone else. We have no conflicts. But only if we do have conflicts do we need norms. The purpose of norms is to help us resolve otherwise unavoidable conflicts. In the Garden of Eden, there is only one type of conflict possible, and that is because one thing is scarce even in the Garden of Eden, and that is our own physical bodies. We have only one. Each of us has only one physical body, and of course, what is also scarce is the standing room of our physical body. So I can have in the Garden of Eden a conflict with you. I want to do something to your body and you don't want this to be done to you. Or I want to stand exactly at the same place that you have already occupied. If that is the case, then there is a conflict and we would need rules even in the Garden of Eden to allow us to avoid these types of conflict. It is easy to see what rule we would likely adopt in the Garden of Eden. I do not go into great detail as far as explaining the rule. It should be intuitively plausible. The rule that we would most likely accept is, I am the exclusive owner of my body, and you are the exclusive owner of your body. I can do with my body whatever I want. If I want to do something to your body, you must give me permission, and vice versa. I can move in the Garden of Eden wherever I want to move, unless that place is already occupied by someone else. If this other person moves away, then I can also move to that place. If we would follow these rules, all conflicts could be avoided. In the real world, of course, we have just scarcity, not just with respect to bodies and standing room, we have all around scarcity. All sorts of things are scarce, and because of that, conflicts are possible with regard to almost everything. So what would be the rules that we would most likely adopt? Again, I do not want to present a full-scale defense of these rules, only make them intuitively plausible at the moment. The first rule would be the same as in the Garden of Eden. I own my body, you own your body. And with respect to everything else, or other scarce goods, the rules we would most likely adopt are, and let me just add this, if you imagine Robinson Crusoe and Friday on an island. If Robinson Crusoe is not the owner of his own body, then we should ask simply, what would be the alternative? Is Friday the owner of Robinson Crusoe's body? But that would cause conflict immediately. And you recall, the purpose of rules is to help avoid conflicts. If Friday would be the owner of Robinson's body, then conflicts would be permanent. Or the other alternative is Friday and Robinson Crusoe both own the body of Robinson, then again, conflicts cannot be avoided unless we assume that there is some sort of perfect harmony that God created, that whatever I want to be done to me is exactly what somebody else wants to be done to me, and so forth. A second rule concerns, how do we acquire property in things that were previously unowned, in nature-given things? And there the answer is, the first person who appropriates something thereby becomes the owner, the exclusive owner of this thing. Again, what would be the alternative? The alternative would be the second owner becomes the owner of it, but that would automatically make the second one be the first one. Conflicts would be not avoided, but conflicts would be permanent. Or they can both be co-owners of these things. But if there is no pre-stabilized harmony of interests, this does not avoid conflicts, it makes conflicts permanent. The next two rules simply follow from those. Next rule is, whatever I produce with the help of my own body and some first appropriated things becomes mine. The producer owns what he has produced. Again, any other rule would not avoid conflict, it would create conflict. Why should be the second one who has not produced it own what I have produced? And the final rule is, property can also be acquired except through original appropriation by voluntary transfer of property from a previous owner to a later owner. As I said, I don't want to go into great detail explaining these rules. I think they are intuitively plausible. I think it is also pretty clear from the outset that if and to the extent that we follow these rules, not only could all conflicts be avoided, but the greatest wealth would be produced. The most easy way to see this is to recognize that if the first owner, someone who has produced something, is not made the owner, the exclusive owner of what he has produced, but he has to share it with other people who have not produced it, the incentive to be a productive individual is, of course, lower than it otherwise would be. So even if we would agree on these rules, then the problem arises, who is the enforcer of these rules? It should be clear that even if we recognize these rules, there will be always people, as long as mankind is what it is, there will always be murderers, kidnappers, robbers, cheaters, and so forth. So we must always reckon with the fact that there are rule breakers, and what do we do with these rule breakers? The standard answer that is given, especially among liberal circles, is this is the sole task of the state or the government to make sure that these rules that I explained, that these rules are adhered to, that nobody violates these rules, and that people who do violate these rules are threatened with punishment. Now, whether this answer is correct or incorrect depends, of course, on how the state is defined. Now, how is the state defined? I don't use any kind of obscure definition here, but the definition that is, so to speak, accepted as a standard definition of a state. And this is the definition. The state is a territorial monopolist of ultimate decision-making in every case of conflict. Whenever there is a conflict, we appeal to the state to decide who is right and wrong, and there is no appeal beyond the state. There's no higher recourse that we can take except go to the state and say, you declare who is right and who is wrong in this case of conflict. Now, what this implies is, if there is an ultimate decision maker in any case of conflict, then the state must also be the institution that determines who is right and wrong in cases of conflict involving itself. That is, if the state is itself part of the conflict, or caused the conflict, or is somehow involved in the conflict, the state then decides also who is right and who is wrong in this regard. Now, what follows from that should be quite obvious. If you are in such a position that you can decide in every case of conflict who is right and wrong, including conflicts involving yourself, then, assuming that you are just a normal person like everyone else, interested in power and money and being richer instead of poorer and all the rest of it, what you can do then is you can cause conflicts, and then you decide these conflicts in your own favor. That is, you can make laws. You can say, you looked in a strange way at me. This is aggression. I define it as aggression. Accordingly, I can hit you on the head, punish you for this, and then tell you in addition what you owe me for this service that I did to you. You should realize that this is, of course, indeed the case whenever we have difficulties with the state. The police, let's say, does something to us. So then we complain, you are not allowed to do this. What happens then? Then the policeman goes to court, or I go to court. Who decides the matter? Someone who is a member of the same organization to which the policeman also belongs. They are both paid out of the same funds, namely out of taxes. The likelihood that a judge will decide against the policeman in my favor is extremely low. So what we get, what we can predict, so to speak, as the almost necessary consequence of having an ultimate decision maker in every case of conflict, what the state is, a monopolist, nobody else can decide above him. That is the ultimate authority. What we then get is a situation where law becomes increasingly perverted and becomes legislation. It becomes perverted in favor of the state and the government itself. And the price that we have to pay for it will become permanently higher. That is, because the state can tell us, because it is the ultimate judge in every case of conflict, what we owe him for this favor that he does us by telling us that he was indeed entitled to rob us, to hit us, to beat us, and all the rest of it, and we have to pay for it. So this is the perfect prescription, so to speak, for tyranny. Now the question is this. We realize that we have reached this point where states have this power over us. How was it possible that such an achievement could be made, that the state could get away with doing this sort of thing? Imagine, for instance, you would just take some kindergartners, some little children, And they beat each other up once in a while, and somebody comes up with, we have to find a solution to this problem that we sometimes have disagreements and solve our internal problems. And one smart kid raises its hand and says, I have the solution. The solution is, in every case of conflict, I decide and nobody else decides. Even if I'm involved in the conflict myself, I decide and nobody else decides. Now, I bet that kindergarten children would be able to see that this is just crazy. I mean, how can you believe that anything except tyranny will arise from this type of arrangement? Nonetheless, we live in a world where this has become, so to speak, the standard view of how the world should be run. And now the question, how was it possible that people accepted something that is absolutely absurd on the face of it? Now I come to some simplified historical reconstruction. Imagine what I call a natural order. In a natural order, we have private property owners, we have small private property owners, we have larger private property owners, we also have some very large private property owners. The reason for this difference that exists is just simply that humans are different. Some people are hardworking, some people are not so hardworking. There are genetic things going on. There is a selection of marriage partners going on. So the fortunes of some people will be enlarged in the course of time because of genetic reasons, because they are particularly smart or they selected particularly good marriage partners. And so forth. So we have, to say it in a simple way, we have, so to speak, common people, we have nobles, and we have kings. In case of conflicts, people will typically turn to judges that are commanding a relatively great respect in their community. They will go to wise people. Let's refer to these people for a moment as they will go to the nobles or they will go to the kings to decide who is right and who is wrong. But these nobles or kings, especially the king, let's say that the king is, so to speak, the person that is most frequently turn to in order to make a determination who is right and wrong, even this king is not a state. The king is not a state insofar as people are free to choose other judges except the king. They might choose one and the same person most of the time, but he is not a monopolist. He's not a monopolist in the sense that everybody else is excluded from it, and he is in particular not a monopolist when it comes to the question, does a king make his own judgment in conflicts involving the king himself? There, other nobles, other high-ranking people are also involved. So he is not yet a state. What he must do in order to become a state is, of course, he must be in a position where he can say, from now on, whenever there is a conflict, you must come to me. You cannot go to anyone else except to me. And even in conflict cases involving myself, I will make the final determination. No one else will make the final determination. Now, it should be clear that the king will not get away with such a thing. Because who will most likely oppose this move in the most outspoken way will, of course, be other nobles who previously also sometimes functioned as judges, because other nobles, of course, realize for them, the danger of a king having this position is particularly high. They have the most to lose from someone who has a monopoly of ultimate decision making, so they will be his opponents in this. So what do kings then do in order to reach the position of a state? And I think what they have done historically in most cases is somehow build a coalition with a simple people, telling the people, look, if you give me this power, then I will free you of all the obligations that you might have vis-a-vis your landlords, your superiors in your job, and so forth. I will lower the rent that you have to pay your landlords, and so forth. So a coalition is built between the king and the people against the nobility that have the greatest interest in stalling the attempt of the king to become a state. But this coalition that led to the king becoming a state has, so to speak, an implicit danger. And this danger is, of course, you invited egalitarian feelings. You got the people on your side because the people realize they can strip the power away from the nobles and enrich themselves at the expense of the nobles. What will the people then do once they have become part, so to speak, of the state run by the king? They will then begin to criticize the king, and what will they criticize the king for is, look what you do, this is by and large a violation of the principle of the equality of all people before the law. Everybody should be treated the same way before the law, but the king obviously is above the law. So what do we have to demand in order to abolish this is, we have to say, we make democratic reforms. Democratic reforms are presented as if they are an attempt to create equality before the law for everyone. No longer is the king alone in a position to determine who is right and wrong. Everybody can become king. Before, entry into the position of the head of the state was limited. Only the king and his heirs could exercise this position. There's no free entry into the position of being the head of state. This is a violation of the principle of equality before the law. Now, is democracy in fact a solution to this problem of there is no equality before the law? Now everybody can become king. It looks like it. But is this really true? And the answer is, no, this is not true at all. As a matter of fact, what has taken place here is simply that personal privileges are exchanged for functional privileges. That is to say, before, the king could do certain things that other people simply could not do. He could tax, for instance, he could make expropriations, for instance, and so forth. Under democracy, this does not change at all. Under democracy, these personal privileges have simply been turned into functional privileges. That is, if you are an elected member of government, everybody can now become king, so to speak, everybody can become president, everybody can become a senator. As a public official, you also have the same privileges that the king had before. You can, for instance, do things that in private law you cannot do. Before we had the higher law of the king and the common law of the people. Now we have a difference between what we call public law on the one hand and private law on the other hand. As private citizens, we are governed by private law. Private law prohibits me from taking your wallet, stealing your wallet, and spending the money. Private law prohibits me from forcing you to work for me. This would be called kidnapping. If I do the same thing as a public official, however, I'm permitted to do this. If I steal from you and I do it as a public official, as a democratic elected politician, then it is called taxes, and that is, of course, legal. If I enslave you as a private person, I would be jailed. If I enslave you by drafting you into the army, then that is just called service for the common good or something like this. If I steal money from you and give it to somebody else, that would be called stealing and fencing of stolen good in private law. If I do it as a politician, it's called social policy, redistribution of income, taking from one and doing it and giving it to someone else. So as far as privileges are concerned, they do not disappear. They become functional privileges instead of personal privileges. But the situation is actually even worse when we turn from a king state, so to speak, to a democratic state. First, consider this. If a state king taxes you more and more, expropriates you more and more, drafts your children into his army and so forth, you tend to resist it because everyone knows I will never be king. The king determines who will be his successor. I will never be king. And because of this, you resent the fact that he exploits, you. If you have open entry into the governmental apparatus, that is, everyone can be king, everybody can be senator in principle, the resistance against exploitation through taxation, regulation, expropriation, and so forth, resistance becomes weaker because everyone can hope, so to speak, that maybe I end up on the other side of this whole business and are a recipient of taxes rather than a payer of taxes. Moreover, a king can, of course, a state king can, of course, be a bad guy. We all know that kings were at times bad guys. But if he is a bad guy, then because he is member of some dynasty, the dynasty is afraid that they might lose their position and they will surround him with people who keep him somewhat under control. And if this guy does not behave better and the dynasty is threatened with losing their control, they might actually determine some distant relative to kill the king off and have him replaced by somebody that is hopefully better. On the other hand, because kings get their position by accident of birth, kings might also be nice people. They might be people who like their population and want to do them good. And so it is not excluded that nice guys will become king. And if they are bad, they will be very frequently killed. Now look at the situation if you have a democratic caretaker. I have some more to say about this caretaker business. So you have democratically elected politicians, every 4, 6 years, 8 years, they are exchanged. First of all, if they are bad, the likelihood that they will be killed off as they deserve to be is comparatively low, because people say, look, we only have to wait for 4 years and then some great, fantastic guy will follow him. It will, of course, never happen, but nonetheless, you do have the feeling the need to kill him is not as urgent as it is if you have a king who might sit there for 30, 40 years. On the other hand, how likely is it that a democratic politician can be a good guy? And there the answer is, that is practically inconceivable. Look, there is competition is not always good. One of the arguments in favor of democracy as compared to monarchy is always, look, you always want to have competition, and democracy has competition for the highest position of the state, whereas a monarchy, there is of course no competition, he has just a monopolistic position for this thing. But competition is only good when it concerns the production of goods. Competition is not good when it comes to the production of bads. We do not want to have competition who is the best person who can kick my teeth out, who is the best person who runs a concentration camp, who is the best person to be the perfect sadist in some prison camp. There we would be happy if we have incompetent people. People who don't know how to beat up people, who are too weak to beat up people. Now, when it comes to competition in the democratic field, you see, recall the definition of a state is they can determine who is right and wrong even in cases that involves themselves. In this situation, with competition for democratically elected politicians, is the worst people will rise to the top. That is, people who are the best liars, the best cheaters, the people who can make the greatest promises that you can imagine with the least likelihood of ever being fulfilled. Imagine, for instance, as a politician, you would say, you know, I'm against any type of expropriation. I will never tax the rich in order to give money to the poor. If the rich have made their money in honest way, I will never touch it. I will never give people who are in desperate need anything except what people give them voluntarily out of their own means. Imagine you would have that as a political platform. Do you think you can be elected as that? The answer is, of course, maybe in a teeny village of 3 or 4 people where everyone knows everyone else, such a thing is possible. But it is absolutely impossible in a country that encompasses millions of people, where there are egalitarian feelings, where people like to vote themselves the property of others. So under democratic conditions, you have, in a way, the smart evil people, the smartest, most evil people rising to the top. It is almost a guarantee. Whereas you can have nice, naive kings due to the fact that they came to their position precisely without having to compete for this position. Let me, in order to illustrate this a little bit more, let me give you some examples. Imagine, for instance, we would have a world democracy. After all, democracy, the basic principle is the more, the better. Switzerland in this sense is not a very good democracy because it excludes, of course, the United States, the United Nations or so from making decisions concerning the Swiss. So the full-blown Democrats should be Democrats who would say we should have a world state and we should have one man, one woman, one vote on a worldwide scale. Now, what would we likely get in this situation? We would get a Chinese-Indian coalition government, simply by virtue of the numbers that they have on their side. Now, what would this Chinese-Indian coalition government do in order to be re-elected the next time? Like, you don't have to be Einstein in order to predict what the decision will likely be. It will be, look, you Italians have far too much. You Germans have far too much. You Americans have far too much. There must be a massive redistribution of income away from Italians, Germans, and in favor of Chinese and Indians and so forth. When the right to vote was expanded in the Western countries in the course of the 19th century, at the beginning there was almost nobody had the right to vote, only people who were large property owners could vote. When that was gradually expanded, what you could see was a rise of the socialist parties. Even liberal parties turned by the end of the 19th century had themselves turned into socialist parties. They still called themselves liberal, but they were all in favor of redistribution. On a worldwide scale, this would have disastrous consequences if you were to do this. That Switzerland is as rich as it is has precisely something to do that they are that small, that they are not subjecting themselves to judgments who vote themselves Swiss property of people who live all over the globe. Or imagine you just lower the age. What's holy about 18? Why not 12? So we say everybody from the age of 12 can vote. Now then I'm not predicting that 12-year-olds will be elected to be president. But what I would predict is, of course, that every political party will have a platform that says, what shall we promise to the kids? And what they will promise to the kids is, every kid needs a toy, every kid needs a hamburger free every second day, pizza free delivery at home, and so forth. All little gadgets have to be done, just as we nowadays please the old people. Because they are the ones that always go and vote. So in that case, we will also have to please the kids, and the redistribution of wealth and income would become even more dramatic than it currently is. Let me just end with a few notes on what democracy has also done to people adopting short-term perspectives. That leads me back to what I said about the king and democratic caretakers. Kings considered the country, so to speak, as their own property. Not justly so, but nonetheless, in their own view, they owned it, indicated by the fact that they could sell certain things off, keep the receipts for themselves, that they could determine who their successor would be. My son will be the next king, my daughter will be the next queen, and so forth. That makes you want to preserve the wealth of the country, at least in most cases, because you want to give some intact property to the next generation. Democratic politicians are temporary caretakers. They do not own the country, but they have the right to use the country to their own advantage for a certain period of time. They do not own it because they cannot determine who will be their successor. They can also not sell it off, parts of it, or large, small or large parts of it, and then keep the money privately. The best way to see this difference is imagine a scenario where in one case I give you a house and tell you, you are the private owner of this house. And in another case, I say, this identical, let's say the house is identical house, I say, you are made for 4 years the caretaker of this house. You can do whatever you want with the house and whatever income you can receive from the house, but you do not own it. You cannot pass it on, and you cannot sell it in the market. Will you treat the houses differently in this situation? And the answer is, of course, clear as daylight, of course you will treat the houses very differently. In one case, where you are the owner, you will be always concerned, what will be the consequence if I do A, B, C, D to the value that the house has in the market? If the value, the market price of the house in the market falls too much, you might say, no, then I will not do A, B, or C. In the other case, if I can only use it for 4 years, but can keep all the receipts myself, then my interest is to get as much out of the house, and I don't care in what shape the house is afterwards. So even if the house falls apart after 4 years, I am, of course, rich after these 4 years, because that's the only thing that I'm permitted to do, take advantage of this house. This is what democratic politicians, so to speak, do. They have fun at the moment at the expense of what comes down in the long run. You have to rip off the country as quickly as possible, because in the long run you will be gone. How can you see this? Just look, for instance, at the monetary policy that you can see in all Western states. First, we have a situation where governments have acquired, democratic governments have acquired the right to print up money as they go. That was comparatively unusual under monarchies. During the monarchical age, that is before the end of World War I, when most countries were still monarchical countries, we did have some commodity money standard, gold or silver standards. You cannot easily inflate if you are on a commodity money standard. But if you have a paper money, what you can do is this. If you increase the amount of paper money, you do not make society as a whole richer. That should be obvious as daylight. The number of goods is just the same. You just have more tickets of paper tickets. So no one can make society richer by printing up more money. If you could do that, we couldn't explain why there are any poor countries in the world, and we couldn't explain why there is any poor person on Earth, because after all, money we can print at will in any amounts overnight. But who benefits from printing up the money? No, those people who get the money first that they print. I print money up, I can buy myself a Mercedes or a BMW. I am richer. Other people are made poorer as a consequence of it. There are not more Mercedeses and BMWs as a consequence of me printing up additional money. But I have it and you don't have it anymore. And all people on fixed incomes are, so to speak, losers in this deal. That is precisely the same attitude. Who cares what is in the long run consequences of my monetary policy? It benefits me right now, and in the long run, I'm all gone, doesn't matter. The same with debt, with public debt. We all are familiar with the fact that we have a tremendous amount of public debt, not only what is officially on the books, even more so all the unfunded liabilities for Social Security, for the pensions that people have to be paid in the future and so forth. It is inconceivable that these debts will ever be paid back. Why are they incurred? And the answer is, those people who incur the public debt do not have to pay them back. We will not put Berlusconi and Merkel and Clinton and Obama and all of these people in jail because they have indebted these countries and will eventually be responsible for bankruptcy that comes our way. But they have right now, of course, the possibility of spending all this money, making lots of friends and having lots of fun trips all over the world, making plenty of presents to this African tribe and that African tribe, and presenting themselves as do-gooders, all at the expense of the general public. So the point that I try to make was, democracy creates a childlike mentality in people. It makes out of grown adults, children who think every one of their little whims and wishes can be immediately satisfied. All you have to do is turn on the printing press, indebt the public more, and let somebody else in the future pay for it all. I think I will stop it at this point. The whole thing has been long anyway. There's some more sessions in the afternoon. I assume I will be here too. And I'm happy to address any type of questions that might arise. What you might want to know, of course, is also what is then the alternative to a democracy. I call that a private law society. I have also written papers. I can also speak about this maybe in the afternoon. But how this alternative would work? That is a society where, indeed, every person and every firm is subject exactly to the same set of laws, namely those laws that I mentioned at the beginning of my speech, where nobody has a right to tax anyone, where nobody is the ultimate judge, even in cases of conflict involving himself, but where there are independent arbitrators and so forth. But as I said, this would require another speech. I thank you very much for enduring this. Thank you.